please. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and Honorable Court. Be seated, please. In case of 10-5097, right hand of the host, Eric A. Holder, Jr., Attorney General of the United States of America, the Senate, the
Ms. Curley? Now, you're here from the University of Georgia.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. Okay. Welcome.
Thank you. And may it please the court. My name is Catherine Curley. I'm here on behalf of pro se appellant Grant Anderson. With the court's permission, I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. This court should reverse the district court's grant of the government's motions to dismiss for 2 reasons. First, the retroactive application of DC's Sex Offender Registration Act, or SORA, violates the ex post facto clause because the statutory scheme is clearly punitive. Additionally, the district court erred when it dismissed Mr. Anderson's...
Now, obviously, what we've got to do is we've got to deal with Smith, right? If Smith were here, we'd be arguing things much differently, but we're arguing under Smith. And it seems to me that SORA may differ from the statute construed in Smith in at least 2 ways, and I'd like you, at least for me, to address those 2 ways. One, in Smith, they didn't have an in-person registration requirement, and in Smith, they didn't have the active notification that you have here. So how do those help you if they do, those differences?
Yes, Your Honor. There are 3 differences.
Also, the third one doesn't interest me at all because when it maybe interests my colleagues, but the fact that you have to register in another state, that's federal law. You have to do that. That it seems to me that doesn't change the scheme at all. So at least for me, I'd like you to address the in-person registration requirement and then the active notification.
Okay. DC's law is distinct from Alaska's law because it authorizes in-person registration and verification, which, as you noted, was not authorized by the Alaska law. There are several contexts in which DC's law authorizes this in-person registration and verification.
How is that punishment, though? I mean, it's clearly it's different, but how is that punishment?
The most problematic provision is one which grants CSOSA the authority to require these meetings at any time for any purpose pursuant to the law. This provision, coupled with the other in-person registration requirements, creates an environment of continuous supervision for the registrant, and it creates a tremendous amount of unpredictability in the registrant's life. The registrant doesn't know when or how often he or she will have to be called in to meet with CSOSA officials. And in this way, it imposes an affirmative...
Is that a real burden in an area that's as small as the District of Columbia? I mean, what? It's not as if you're pulling him in from long distances.
Respectfully, yes, Your Honor. For an individual to hold a job, if that individual may have to come in and meet with CSOSA officials as often as daily, that would be a tremendous burden in that individual's life. Additionally...
Is this a facial problem or a question of whether that actually ever happens?
Imagine
that it never happens. This is discretionary on the part of the whatever entity is responsible for this, right?
Yes, Your Honor. It is discretionary.
So, does any punishment occur if no punishment occurs?
There is punishment here because there's a constant threat that these provisions could be carried out by government officials.
If they're never carried out, how is it punishment?
Respectfully, Your Honor, the question here is a facial challenge, so it's whether the language of the law on its face presents an ex post facto violation. And here, because this language grants a tremendous amount of unfettered discretion to government authorities without any guidance, that's a way in which this law is punitive.
I guess I'm still not saying how it's punitive. I mean, I can see how it's punitive if it's actually used that way. At least I can see the argument. But if it's only discretionary, and if the fact, unless you don't have any facts suggesting that they've been using it in this way, that's not enough to strike the law on its face. It might be enough to strike the law with respect to an individual application, but the mere possibility doesn't seem to be enough to show punishment.
Well, the fact that the mere possibility is there, Your Honor, is the threat hanging over the registrant's head. And it's this threat that individual must live with every day.
Is the registrant also on parole?
Is not in every case.
No, this your particular registrant.
Yes, Mr. Anderson is.
So doesn't he have the threat of having to come in and visit his parole officer whenever the parole officer asks for him?
He does, Your Honor, but the parole and probation conditions are distinct from what this law is requiring.
But we're talking about the in-person part. The parole officer can tell him to come in anytime he wants, can he?
My understanding would be as to Mr. Anderson, but there are many individuals that may not be on probation or parole that this law would apply to. And as this is a facial challenge, Mr. Anderson can raise the way in which this law affects him.
He can, but if the majority of people under the law are also on parole, then it's not facially illegal, right? The rules about what's facial and what's not require, I can't remember exactly what the Supreme Court's opinion on this is, but it requires that, you know, a substantial number of people are going to be subject to the problem, not just one person. And I guess it strikes me now as we're talking, we don't have any idea how many people who are subject to this law are also under parole.
That's true, Your Honor. And this, concededly, the standard for a facial challenge is not perfectly clear. I think what you're referring to is the United States Supreme Court decision, United States versus Salerno.
Yes, but that is what I'm referring to. Thanks.
The court there did not clearly apply that standard and has not consistently applied that standard for facial challenges since then.
That's right. There's some back and forth about it, but there's never been a situation where the court has not required some showing of some percentage of the people covered by the law will have the problem.
Yes, Your Honor.
The issue about Salerno was what percentage are required.
Right, but I think there is at least some percentage here who would not be on probation and parole who would be required to come in under the provisions of this law at any time that CSOSA officials deemed appropriate. In addition to the in-person verification and registration requirements, the law also authorizes not only passive notification, but also active notification.
Why is that a problem? I mean, Justice Kennedy, I thought, was pretty clear that what he was concerned about with notification, what the court was concerned about with notification, was that people who really didn't have a reason to know about the registrant status getting that information right. Isn't that what was animating his concern in Smith?
Yes, Your Honor. I think to some extent, the court in Smith did seem to draw somewhat of a line, or at least found it noteworthy, that Alaska's law only authorized passive and not active notification. And the court recognized that the burden on the registrant would increase to the extent that the publicity increased. Here, it's not only that active notification is authorized, it's also that the means by which this information is disseminated and the audience who receives this information are entirely unrestricted. So the publicity
it's a matter of resources here. Who are the police going to notify actively about the registrant's status? It's going to be folks in the neighborhood, right?
The police, under the provisions of this law, the police could notify any resident in D.C. without regard to whether that resident lives in close geographical proximity to the sex offender. So the fact that this is unrestricted both as to the audience and as to the means as well, there's a list of authorized means of disseminating this information in the statute. The list includes door-to-door contacts, telephone calls, direct mailings, community flyers, but the list is not exclusive. So the District of Columbia or the police department officials could go so far as to post billboards under the provisions of this law throughout D.C. announcing a sex offender's identity and presence in the district. And this would be incredibly humiliating. While passive notification or making this information available to those who would seek it out may be necessary to promote the public safety purpose of this law, it's not necessary to have this active notification, which is entirely unrestricted. So in this way, these active notification provisions are entirely excessive with regard to the rational purpose of the law. And in addition to the in-person registration reporting requirements and the active notification, the law authorizes there's a multi-jurisdiction registration requirement, which requires any individual who moves, attends school, or works in another jurisdiction to register in that jurisdiction. The reason why this provision is punitive is because there are individuals who are required to register in D.C. that may not be required to register in other jurisdictions.
What will it mean to have to register in another jurisdiction if the other jurisdiction has no mechanism for registering? What will that mean?
Respectfully, that's a good question, Your Honor. If that person can't...
Well, yes, but I need an answer. I need the answer.
If that person cannot register, is not required to register in that jurisdiction,
yeah.
It's unclear if they could register in that jurisdiction. And D.C. makes it a penalty for failure to comply with the requirements of this law.
But if it's impossible, I imagine the person has an impossibility defense. So we've had some experiences with this law. Has there ever, when was law passed?
In 1999, I believe it was enacted in 2000.
Has any person in the history of the enforcement of the law ever been penalized for trying but failing to register in another state because the other state doesn't have a registration system?
There's nothing on the record below, Your Honor, but as this is a facial challenge, the question is whether an individual could be punished under D.C.'s law for failure to register in another jurisdiction, even if that jurisdiction did not require it.
And you don't have any idea what the law is on that subject. I mean, we don't have any idea what their enforcement rule is, and we don't have any idea what the Court of Appeals, actually, the only thing we know about what the Court of Appeals of the District of Columbia thinks is that this is constitutional. But we don't have any idea whether they would penalize somebody for not being able to do something that they're not able to do.
That's true, Your Honor, but the law at least states that failure to comply with the provisions of the law will result in a fine and a 180-day jail time.
How many states do not have Megan's laws?
Every state has a sex offender registration law.
And also, isn't this Adam Walsh law, the federal law? That's a national registry.
It is, Your Honor. That's correct.
So, I mean, he's going to be on that, irrespective of whether he's... And I don't know whether that's broken down statewide or how that's, do you know how that's enforced?
I don't know. And it's accurate that Mr. Anderson, I think, would have to register under the federal law, but there are still individuals who would not have to register under the federal law or under other states' laws that would have to register under D.C.'s law. So there's at least some gap there with regard to this multi-jurisdiction registration requirement as to a group of individuals that wouldn't be required to register other than in D.C. So it would, even with the federal law, it would impose an affirmative disability or restraint and restrict the free movement of those individuals that would not be required to register outside of D.C. It's these three provisions taken together which render this law punitive in effect. And they are further exacerbated by the fact that this law does not have an individualized risk assessment to determine when the most egregious provisions apply, such as the in-person verification requirements and the active notification requirements.
Ask one question about the in-person. In the Alaska law required, said he must permit the authorities to photograph and fingerprint him. Isn't that an in-person requirement?
It is, Your Honor, and there's a provision of the D.C. law which already makes an accommodation for that. So the fact that the D.C. law also has a provision which states CSOSA officials can require these meetings at any time for any purpose pursued.
So it's not the in-person part. It's the discretionary at any time part is the problem.
It's the grant of this unfettered discretion that makes it most problematic, but it is that coupled with the requirement for in-person periodic registration that makes that provision punitive. Yes. This law also lacks an...
I take it your point is that this is like a... It becomes something like a condition of parole then, and it's increasing the parole officer's supervisory capacity. Is that the idea that it's what's really happening here is as if the parole terms have been changed after the fact?
Yes, Your Honor. And this, to the extent that this is analogous to increasing the terms of probation and parole, that's one way in which it's clearly punitive. This law also does not provide any opportunity for relief from the provisions. So if an individual is rehabilitated, they must continue to comply with the requirements of this law.
That was true in Alaska too, wasn't it?
I'm not certain, Your Honor, but at least with regard to Alaska's law, the provisions did not go nearly this far.
That's a different question, but right? Those are two different questions. I think you made a point. The other point, which Judge Griffith is not interested in, but I did want to ask you about anyway. You had this argument in the brief that
I'm not paying attention.
that the District of Columbia has no interest in the public safety of other states. Is that right? So my guess is that if you're on parole in the District of Columbia and you murder somebody in Maryland, that your parole in the District of Columbia can be revoked. Isn't that right?
That would be my understanding.
So apparently we do care somewhat about what happens in other states.
And my understanding is that's only in the context of probation and parole. And the Supreme Court, or the line of cases that we cited in our brief, states that states do not have an interest which justifies their regulation or punishment of conduct which takes place outside of their borders. This is relevant because...
Why isn't that an example of exactly that? We want to stop people from murdering people in Maryland. Why would the District of Columbia not... Why would it be irrational for the District of Columbia to try to prevent its citizens from murdering people in Maryland? It seems like a perfectly reasonable thing to do.
Well, in this case, it wouldn't be committing... The crime would be failing to register.
But that is the crime, but the purpose is to enhance the public safety with respect to sex offenders.
Yes, yes. And I am aware that it's okay within the conditions of probation and parole to punish an individual if that individual violates a crime outside of, or violates the law outside of that jurisdiction. But at least with regard, the Supreme Court precedent that's cited, at least with regard to this multi-jurisdiction registration requirement, is on point, because the Supreme Court has held that states don't have an interest which justifies, I guess, outside of the parole and probation context.
The case you cite, I think, is a tort case, isn't it? Was that BMW case?
Well, yes.
That seems considerably different. That has to do with sort of the due process connection between the state and the incident occurring in another state. Here, it's our own a violator. It's somebody who committed a crime in the District of Columbia whose activity we want to control somewhere else. It's not the same as some tort occurring somewhere else.
Respectfully, though, I do think that the reasoning is somewhat parallel. If an individual fails to register in Alaska, it doesn't advance the public safety of D.C. citizens to punish that individual to fail to register in Alaska.
We're back on the question of whether it protects the safety of Alaskan citizens. Let me ask one more question. On the Fifth Amendment claim,
yes, Your Honor.
So I take it from the way in which your briefs are constructed that if you were to lose the argument that we should read the complaint broadly or that the district court should have amended the complaint, you're not making an argument that he's made out a Fifth Amendment claim. It's only if we liberally read the complaint or if we, more liberally than the district court did, or if we require an amendment. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor. If you find that the district court erred when it failed to provide Mr. Anderson with the requisite procedural guidance, concededly his complaint is missing one of the three elements of a Fifth Amendment claim.
Which element is it missing?
The fact that he asserted his Fifth Amendment claim in the face of substantial punishment when he would be required to give incriminating statements.
Okay.
If there are no further questions...
You can listen now if you want.
I've been listening.
All right, you're over your time. We'll give you a couple minutes. Ms. Wilson? Ms. Lyons. All right. How does the Adam Walsh Law work? Do you know who enforces it? I mean, is this national registry?
I know a little bit about it, Your Honor. The Adam Walsh Law authorizes the FBI to maintain a national registry of sex offender information that's contributed by the states and the District of Columbia and other jurisdictions.
So does that mean every state, does that require every state to have a registry that they can then report to the FBI on?
The way that the federal government has done it is to make conditional certain law enforcement funds that are granted to states. Mm-hmm. So in that way, it has compelled effectively all 50 states to pass a Sex Offender Registration Act, and that is the mechanism by which the information is contributed to the national database, not unlike the national DNA database.
Kind of so that similar. If this man is required to register in Maryland, if he works there or goes to school there or in Virginia, the national registry would make that almost superfluous because he'd show up on the national registry.
He might, but I think it's important to recognize that the residents of Maryland or Virginia might check their own local resources as opposed to going to a national registry. It may be duplicative, but I don't think it's...
Okay.
And the other thing I think to recognize is that Mr. Anderson in particular is on parole. He's on parole for the remainder of his life, and the definition of the Washington metropolitan area for purposes of his parole includes the near and suburbs in both Maryland and the District of Columbia. So he's already sort of on parole in those jurisdictions. With all due respect, may it please the court, the heart of this case is the nature of the DC Sex Offender Registration Act's provisions. Because the law exists to promote public safety and is not punitive, the court should conclude, as the DC Court of Appeals did, that the statute does not violate the ex post facto clauses of the Constitution. Much of the discussion this morning has revealed sort of the fundamental flaw in this case, which is that there aren't very many facts pleaded in the complaint or included in the motion for a preliminary injunction or other responses filed by Mr. Anderson, which, while generally coherent and intelligent, do not include very many facts. But I'd like to start by pointing out, going back to his status as a parolee, because that's what distinguishes him from both unconvicted citizens with all of their freedoms and people who were at issue, say, in Smith or in the D.C. Court of Appeals In Re W.M. case. Those are sex offenders who were not on parole and had, in some cases, completed sex offender treatment programs and were in a very different status from
Can I pause over this? I may not have heard right. The statute doesn't only apply to people who are on parole.
No, Your Honor.
So could you just elaborate a little bit on the discussion I was having with opposing counsel on the question of facial attack versus an as-applied. I mean, her argument is that, well, some people are not on parole, and so whatever disabilities the defendant has in this case, the petitioner has in this case, would not apply across the board. She's attacking it facially, so...
I understand that.
Basically,
Your Honor,
she's saying she can, you know, we should ignore the argument about the fact that he's on parole.
I don't think it would be appropriate to do that. It's my understanding that ordinarily a facial challenge cannot be brought on a statute's constitutionality unless the person who's bringing it has a successful challenge as the law is applied to him. So the first step is to see whether Mr. Anderson has any chance of demonstrating unconstitutionality as the law is applied to him.
So this is like no overbreath in non-First Amendment issues. You're citing a particular case or this proposition? Or?
I don't have one off the top of my head, Your Honor. I'm sorry this morning.
That's right. Okay, thank you.
But that's my response to that. We haven't had very much discussion this morning of the In Re W.M. case from the D.C. Court of Appeals in 2004.
You know, as you might guess, I'm interested in the in-person registration requirements and in the active notification. How do you respond to opposing counsel's argument on those, that the in-person notification requirement is punitive because it's a threat hanging over Mr. Anderson at all time, that he's subject to the whim of C. Sosa here at any moment?
As Judge Garland pointed out correctly, Mr. Anderson, as a parolee, has to deal with his parole officer.
Now, isn't this adding a whole another government actor in there, hanging that threat over him? Isn't that something different?
No, Your Honor. C. Sosa, the court supervision offenders.
Do they work through the parole officer?
C. Sosa. It's the same entity that supervises.
This isn't enhancing the parole officer's authority to or discretion to.
No, Your Honor.
The parole officer has no new authority as a result of SORA than he did if there was no SORA, in terms of being able to call in Mr. Anderson.
No, the discretion rests with the parole officer under both the parole conditions and under the statute.
What about active notification? She says that there's no limit on the notice that can be given by the police here. It could be any person in the district at any time. What's your response to that?
That only applies to Class A offenders, which Mr. Anderson concededly is.
Yeah.
But there are absolutely no facts.
Could they put up a billboard in D.C. with his name and face and address and saying sex offender?
There is absolutely nothing in the record to suggest that anything has ever been done on active notification with regard to Mr. Anderson, so that's a very hypothetical. Could they? If they did, that would present a very different question for the court than what we have on this record here.
I understand that, but could they do it? Does the statute give them that authority?
The statute doesn't restrain the means of active notification, but I would have to think there would be an extreme circumstance of public safety to single one particular sex offender out. Something along the lines of, you know, an America's Most Wanted sort of situation.
So because the court in Smith was concerned about only those folks who have a reason to know having access to this information, what limit is placed on the police's ability, on active notification under SORA? What's the outer limit of what they can do?
The outer limit of what they can do, of course, Your Honor, will have to be established through case law. The statute merely authorizes active notification. It does not set an outer limit.
Have the police engaged in any active notification in Mr. Anderson's case?
There is certainly none referenced in this record, Your Honor. I'm not aware of any. The other thing my opposing counsel mentioned is the lack of an individualized risk assessment for each sex offender. That was taken care of by the Supreme Court in the Connecticut Department of Public Safety case in 2003. And as for the Fifth Amendment claim, Your Honor, and the procedural problem, that's mostly a matter of trying to interpret the facts that are pleaded. There's never been any case that required a court to advise a pro se person that he had an ability to amend. I would also note that there's no motion for reconsideration that Mr. Anderson filed once he sort of became aware of the burden. And if there are no further questions, I would respectfully ask that the court affirm the decision below.
Thank you. Ms. Wilson?
Good morning. Mary Wilson for the District of Columbia. The discussion and questioning this morning highlights that the law at issue here, like the Alaska law in Smith, is a legitimate, non-punitive regulatory scheme enacted for the purpose of promoting public safety. And its effect is consistent with that purpose, to promote public safety by alerting the public of the risk posed by sex offenders in the community. Like in WM, this court should conclude that there's no ex post facto problem with the law. To briefly address the deference issue, though the court can affirm without reaching the issue, this court should defer to the D.C. Court of Appeals' construction of the D.C. statute in WM, just as other circuits defer to the highest state court's construction of state law.
What is the dispute about construction?
The dispute about, well, the argument that Anderson makes that the intent of the statute was punitive.
That's not a construction question.
Well, I believe that both Smith...
It's a legislative history question. The way you've argued it, that's a legislative history question.
Well, both Smith and WM refer to that underlying question as a question of statutory construction. In Smith at 92, whether the statutory scheme is civil or criminal is first of all a question of statutory construction. And WM picks up on that language also and says it's a question of statutory construction. The Supreme Court says in Smith that you have to consider the text and structure of the statute to determine the legislative objective. So we submit that that underlying issue is an issue of statutory construction, to which this court should defer to the local courts. And if there are no other questions, we'll submit on our brief in the U.S. Attorney's argument.
All right, thank you. All right, why don't you take 2 minutes?
And may I start with a question? I now have one concern.
I'm not going to pay any attention to this.
So how do you respond to government's argument that the in-person notification requirement of SORA doesn't add anything to what the parole officer can already do. There's no new burden that's placed on Mr. Anderson that he doesn't already experience.
Respectfully, I disagree, because there's an entire statute which is explicitly granting authority to CSOSA officials to do something independent and irrespective of whatever is required under the terms of probation and parole. So it is an additional requirement, and certainly would clearly be as to those individuals that are not on probation and parole. As the government conceded, there is no limitations on the means by which active notification can be carried out.
Can I pause? I actually was paying attention. Isn't the answer to this issue that he's not on parole for the rest of his life, and he is under SORA for the rest of his life, so that at some point he will no longer have the parole restriction? I assume he's not on parole for the rest of his life. Maybe I'm wrong about that.
I think he is on lifetime parole.
Okay.
But there would be individuals who would not be on probation and parole for life, but they would still be required to register under this statute for life.
What about opposing counsel's point that you can't make a facial attack if you don't come within the scope of that facial attack? That is, we make an exception for overbreath arguments under the First Amendment. This is not a First Amendment case, and in general, we don't have overbreath. And so you have to at least have to show that you would come within the scope of the people who are affected in this way.
And Mr. Anderson, as a Class A offender, would be within the scope of the requirements of this law. So at least with regard to the requirement that, or the authority that CSOSA has to require these in-person meetings at any time for any purpose pursuant to the law, and the fact that Mr. Anderson could be subjected to the most extreme types of notification, he would have standing to raise the claim here. This law is truly a question of first impression for this court. No other court has upheld a law which has these three provisions in it. And it's the cumulative effect of these three provisions which render the law punitive in effect and in violation of the ex post facto clause. If there are no further questions.
All right, thank you. And Ms. Curlett, you were appointed, or the University of Georgia Litigation Clinic was appointed to represent him. You've done a wonderful job. And are you Professor Hashimoto?
Yes.
Well, you run a very good program.
Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot. Thank you.
And my best to Professor Kunin when you see him.
Thank you.